Thank you for your patience. It's a great honor and a great, great pleasure to have you both here, Russell Simmons and Rick Rubin. I hope you will come back many times, and I hope that someday we will be honored to actually protect your archives in one form or another. Whether here or at the Schomburg, we have the new president of the Schomburg here tonight, it is important that this history be told. In Hebrew, the word for tradition and transmission are the same. Now, since we're already in the spiritual realm, Rick Rubin asked me that we begin in a certain way. And he will lead us into this way. I have to say that a few months ago, I was a Beastie Boys virgin. I had never heard the I had heard of the Beastie Boys, but I had never listened to the Beastie Boys, and I listened to them about 6 months ago. And what we're about to do now will also be the very, very first time I put myself in this situation of immersion. So, Rick Rubin, help us. What are we going to do?
Okay, we're all going to close our eyes for 3 minutes. And let's do that. Let's close our eyes. And we're going to focus on our breathing, just the inhale and the exhale. And the goal of this is to bring us all together this evening, giving thanks that we're all here and getting to participate in this event. And we're just going to focus on our breath. 3 minutes of silence.
Could be a brain break.
Let's do it. breath, stretch.
Okay. Mick was the first.
Thank you.
Isn't that much better than Angel Dust? The first person that meditated with me, Rick, first person to go to yoga around me. I didn't, many years ago. I went there because of the chicks, I think, really, but Rick, the first meditator I knew. Yeah. Anyway, now it's popular. All the schools have it. And all of you, I hope it's a gift for you that you sit still, let your thoughts settle more often. Do that 20 minutes twice a day. Makes you high as hell. All right. Eddie?
Why did you want us to do this?
It just seemed like a good opportunity. There's a power that happens when a big group of people gather together and when they meditate. When we practice at home ourselves, there's one amount of energy, but there's like a multiple that happens when a big group get to do it together. I just thought it would be nice for people to get to share a moment and create a space in the room for something new.
While, I mean, for someone like myself who's done this for the first time, it was not easy.
Yeah. Well,
it's. I mean, it really. I did open my eyes a few times and peeked. You didn't.
It takes. I would say, you know, it takes a little patience. But when Rick's making a record, I'm gonna speak for him. Every time I've ever made a decent record, there were these seconds, and melody does this. Music is one of the most transformative things in terms of happiness or presence. You want the world to move slow so you can watch it unfold. And music does that. The notes, in between the spaces of the notes, there's this awareness. All the other shit disappears, it's just the music. And you're making that great record, there's no thoughts, oh, wait till I get this money. I'm going to get this made back. I'm going to do this shit. It's like, wow, the music. And it awakens you. People use it as a transformative thing. It's why music is so powerful. It brings you to the present. And meditation is a practice that brings you to the present. It's the same thing. It's, you want the world to go. So if you drive your car, you see every flower, every fucking thing, every cute butt, everything. You see it. And that's what meditation is for, is so you can see the world unfolding, miracles.
And we, it would seem, I mean, I know you, Rick, you lead a life where contemplation is very important. It would seem that our lives today are made of very few opportunities like that. I mean, I with this machine you have there and that I have too, the BlackBerry, I feel like everybody's, are you checking? It's okay. Yeah, no. Everybody in the street seems to be davening, you know, constantly walking around and not really looking at the world. And it was hard. I must say, this was not an easy exercise. I think it was easier to listen to the Beastie Boys and to meditate for 3 minutes.
Was that hard?
No, that wasn't hard. But it because you well, first of all, I was wondering, how do you know it's 3 minutes?
It felt like 3 minutes. It felt like 3 minutes. And when you start doing it, you start getting a sense.
Was it 3 minutes? Do you think?
Fuck no.
But you know,
it felt like
interesting. Anyway,
like 20 minutes.
But if it was difficult for you to do, the more difficult it was for you to do,
right,
the more you needed it.
That's for sure.
Boy, do I need it.
You need.
You are quite right.
Yeah.
Let's do it again. No.
okay.
I was interested.
You want your children to be spacious brains so they can let things come in. And, you know, and creative people need to be able to be awake, you know, so they can be. Nothing happens. No happiness, no creativity. Nothing happens except those seconds of presence. And he does that to lengthen those seconds.
And you think there's a relationship between that exercise and the way Rick works?
He's a meditative person, I think. He can say that.
Being porous in some way, open. Being ears. I mean, this is what attracted me so much as I learned more and more about your career, was the fact that you listen, that you both listen.
That's the job. That's our job.
But it's harder to listen than to talk.
You have to practice.
When you, I'll begin with you, Rick. When you were graduating from Long Beach High School in 1981, In the senior yearbook, the quotation there you chose is, I want to play loud, I want to be heard, I want all to know I'm not one of the herd.
Poet.
Fantastic. I love it. In a way, quite different from what we're doing now, or not?
Same thing. I think it's all the same. I feel there's a unifying principle through all of it that makes, at least it makes sense to me.
When you were both growing up, you went to a lot of hip-hop clubs in New York. And I'd like you to tell us some of the stories of those early days when you discovered, as it were, hip-hop, what your first experience of hip-hop was.
Do you want to go first?
No, you go ahead.
Me go first? Mm. There was a club on 2nd Avenue called Negril, which was a reggae club. And on, I think it was Tuesday nights. Was it Tuesday nights?
I think so.
They had the first places that I found where you could hear hip-hop live anywhere. And DJs would DJ through the night, and MCs would MC, and it was like a whole different world that I hadn't seen before, and it was really limited at that time, because, again, if you were in downtown Manhattan, that was pretty much your only opportunity to see it. And then eventually, over time, it grew and got bigger, and then it moved to the Roxy. And I remember going to the Roxy on the first night that the Roxy opened as a hip-hop club, and there were maybe 50 of us in the Roxy, which is this giant, you know, giant space. And then slowly, you got to watch every week, more people came, and more people came, and more people came, and word traveled, and it really happened completely organically. The whole scene was rooted in word of mouth. It had nothing to do with, it didn't seem like anyone was promoting this world. It was just it just happened on a street level. And I got swept up in it. Russell was already swept up in it.
Organic, there was nobody promoting it at the beginning?
Well, Russell was.
You were.
Yeah, but my first experience was, there was a place, Charles Gallery, and it was 1976, I guess, 6 or 7, and there was a rapper, Eddie Chiba. And it was Tuesday nights, ironically, right? It was Tuesday nights, and I went in there, and he was on the mic. And it was crazy because it was music that was not on the radio. It was some alternative that was created by people who didn't, you know, want to join the mainstream, or just, I think that experience is not unlike, you know, the way people first experienced jazz or blues or rock and roll, or first created. They did this because on the radio was Patrick Juvet, I Love America, or YMCA by the Village People, or whatever was on the radio. It was just foreign to the hood. This was in Charles Gallery, 125th Street in Harlem. So it was dramatically, you know, it was our own shit. So it felt like we walked in and said, wow, this is, and the music they chose was from, you know, pre-disco, or old rock and roll records, Billy Squire's Big Beat to I don't know if it was Bob James, Apache, or Bob James, Mardi Gras. They made their own music. James Brown, all his drum beats were good, funky drummer especially. And they played their own music, created their own cultural thing that they could claim.
And when you use, and I think both of you would use the word perhaps in a similar way, you use the word counterculture.
It's counterculture if you're in the outside, but if you come up and it starts developing, it gets culture. You know, like, I didn't really, like, it was counterculture to the extent that there were other clubs, black clubs, that didn't like us. We weren't really accepted, no way.
They didn't like you because?
No, they were like, you'd have to have on a sport jacket, and you had to have a certain, you know, shoes on, and, you know, you had to be a certain way to get in, and we weren't really acceptable. So the hip-hop explosion was people who didn't want to join the mainstream, didn't want to, or really weren't accepted anyway. That's why downtown, Rick experienced hip-hop before they let hip-hop into those kind of mainstream clubs that we were starting to frequent, you know, Bentley's and Leviticus and Justine. There's all these black clubs where guys would have, like, you know, Louis Vuitton clutch bags and shit, you know, and shoes with no socks, and, you know, it was just a different kind of dude. So we did something, and it was counterculture to the extent
Absolutely.
That we want to do our shit, and we were, like, you know, had disdain for. And I think even the music we produced and Rick did the same from a rock example, I think, but he'll tell you about that. I felt the records I produced, I didn't want to hear anything that sounded, because it was now developing R&B trend as I started to make records. And that R&B trend was all that soft, happy, and it was really something. We didn't want to use any instrumentation. Larry Smith and myself, when we made records, finally got to make records, which was years later because we had Curtis Blow in between and whole development thing. But the records we made, we didn't use any instrumentation that were on any records that were on anything to do with black radio. So it was a counter thing, but it was ours. I didn't feel it was counter to them, but it was ours. And it was us intentionally, you know, being young.
And the last two words that you use seem to me so powerful, being young. Because one of the things that strikes me most in discovering Def Jam through this utterly magnificent book, I must say,
that's no shit.
Just get it, okay? Don't leave home without it. I mean, I know I sound like an advertisement for a credit card, but it is absolutely outstanding. You produced it in the most exquisite way, and all the writers, it is Bill for helping me so much understand, to use your language, all this shit. I mean, I mean, it's a pleasure to use it in this library. I must say, it is just wonderful. There's so much to learn, but what I find so extraordinary about it is just the level of undiluted passion and youth. And that seems to me one of the shining lights. I mean, my 9-year-old boy, of course, brings it to me now, but just the power of the birth of something that is so attractive. Def Jam is all about youth in the most substantial way. Am I right?
So it was about street culture. It's about street culture. And it's the power of this music. I would say the closest parallel would be punk rock. It was music made by people who weren't usually educated in music, but who really loved this art form, and who at the time when we started, there was no real upside in doing it. Everyone who was doing it purely out of the love of doing it, because you weren't going to get your records on the radio, because if you listen to the radio, it was so alien to the radio. It was its own thing. And I'm surprised that it ended up being our jobs. Yeah. You know,
that was a dream.
It's unbelievable.
That was the dream that you might be able to. Just, it didn't matter if I slept in Rick's dorm for the rest of my life. To be able to do that, that inspiration, to have that, to go to work on that, to produce or to manage or to work with the artists, any of the jobs in that industry, even to promote their shows, was a dream. And so to be able to do that for a living was, again, a high aspiration for it to become the kind of job that it became, and the, you know, the fringe benefits of it have been great, but the work itself was such a prayer. And it's been that's the experience.
I mean, punk rock, in the book you say, to me Def Jam was an outgrowth of punk rock expressed through black music. It was about counterculture. And you say the experience that I had going to hip-hop clubs, which was the greatest experience, wasn't being equaled by the records I could buy. And therefore, because you couldn't find the records to buy, you couldn't find the counterculture sufficiently around you, you created it.
That was the goal, was just to document what hip-hop was like. And luckily, the fact that at least I didn't know anything. I came in not knowing anything about music or about the record business or anything. I was a kid in college who loved music. I just would go to these clubs, hear this music, get inspired, and want to create something in a recording that gave me the same feeling that I had in these places live. And no records were doing that. So it was really more like a documentarian kind of a role.
But it was also trying in some way to give people a strong feeling of what it meant to be in a live audience.
it was to experience what hip-hop was. It didn't matter if it was in a live audience or not. It's just the only place that we could experience it at that time was in a live audience. It wasn't contingent on being in a club for it to be great, but the only place you could hear it great at that time was in a club because the records sounded like R&B records.
Why?
Because the people who were making records were experienced record makers who made R&B records.
So they
and then rap came along, and they made the same R&B records and had a guy rap on top instead of having a girl singing on it.
That's right.
So they thought that was a rap record. And in a way it was because there was somebody emceeing instead of singing, but musically it was a very, very different thing.
I only for a few years I made records. You didn't have to have a stitch of talent, but have a real appreciation for the culture to make records that were dramatically different. And I mean, I was surrounded by talent. I had a Larry Smith, and we made records, and said, no, we're not using any of those instruments. We're going home now. And the engineer and Larry, who was such a brilliant musician, he made great Houdini records, which were some of the records that probably infuriated Rick. They were good at what they were, and they were really good and cultural, and for Houdini, they were the best expression for them. But making, like, Run-DMC's early records was like no one, all the talented people, all the people with melody in their heart, couldn't figure out why we wanted to make these spare records that just were inspired by the culture more than melody. The melody was implied, but we made records that were dramatically different because we weren't musicians. And Rick came along and made records the same way. But Rick is a musical genius. It's a genius. So. But he had to come into his own. He made his records like. His first record was when he fixed up I Need a Beat, and we put it out. I remember that wasn't the first, but that was the record that I remember we opened up Def Jam, and I remember selling out the box with cellophane around it, and we went to the store. You remember this? We went to the store, and the records were selling, and didn't know what the fuck was in them. Like, no one knew what was in the records. He had made a record before that with the same logo because Rick invented Def Jam, and he put out a record, I remember, and I had, you know, some of those records were kind of R&B that, you know, I produced, and some were more just straight hip-hop, probably you liked them,
yeah,
right?
Sucker MCs was the...
Right, Sucker MCs, the Rock Box, they were different. Incredible. We found different instrumentation.
Incredible.
But and then Rick came along and made...
And the Jimmy Spicer records. Incredible.
Yeah, but they were still, you know, they would get... They, you know, I had to be musicians and fuck with me. But what Rick made was so dramatic. I remember that record. He made a record before that, and the way that I came to meet Rick was he made this record... Commentating, illustrating, description giving, adjective expert, analyzing some. I don't remember shit all the dust, but I remember this. Musical myth seekers. It was like, oh shit, the fuck is this? We had to find, I had to find him. Like, they brought him to me. This is the only record on the radio that I cared about. And it was his record, and that was Def Jam. It was his first logo. And
so, I mean, with
it was Tito Rock was the artist.
Well, I am here with you now. I mean, in this moment, tell me about the first time the two of you met?
Jazzy J, who's a friend, a mutual friend, brought us together.
We actually met, I think we met before that. But
okay,
I'll tell you when I think. You tell me when you think.
You're right. I'm sorry.
I think we met at, do you remember there
Cafeteria?
Was that? No, at Graffiti. You remember Graffiti Rock?
Yeah.
That show?
Yeah.
There was a party after it, a loft somewhere on the west side, and I met you at that party.
Really?
Yeah, and I was excited. I was excited to meet you because your name was on all these great records. So,
well, anyway, so when Jazzy J brought him to me, I had a time. I was a manager of artists, and I had some of the only artists that really had decent deals. Or other deals were decent. She just passed. God bless. But yeah, I was really laughing. I had Houdini and Run-DMC and some other artists. So. Meeting, starting this whole process with Rick, I'm going to start my record company. I had Rush Records. I was almost going to make a deal. And then Rick said, no, fuck with me. And I went to his dorm, and he had a drum machine. Before I had still worked without drum machines. I was just starting to work with drum machines, and Rick had a drum machine. And his drum machine had 50 hit records on it. It was just drums, but it was 50 hit records. Anybody open their mouth on top of these drums, yeah, they hit. It was amazing. So going and saying, wow, he says, well, give me $2,000, we'll have a rec company. And we started the rec company out of his dorm. And the first record that he produced for this label was I Need a Beat by LL Cool J. And the story I told you about going to the store and people buying a box of records, you know, 25 records were sold out of that store, and no one knew what was inside. We had to open up one of the boxes and play and pay for the record and play it for the record store owner so he could know what the fuck he was selling, because it was nobody. It was just people can smell good music. Or maybe it was the logo from the previous record you made, but for some reason they had sold 25 records in a day, and we were the first to play the record for the record store owner. And it was called I Need a Beat by LL Cool J. That was the first Def Jam record.
We'll be listening to it. How great. Chuck D from Public Enemy says, Rick thought like I thought my whole life. He wanted to totally destroy what was proven. Now, let's listen to track 4.
Commentating, illustrating, description giving, adjective expert, analyzing some of the musical myths, seeking people of the universe. This is yours. It's yours. Do you like it?
Yeah.
Do you want it?
Yeah.
Well, if you had it, would you flaunt it?
Hell yeah.
Well, it's yours. Taking a record that's already made with the help of the mix board used in the crossfade. Rhythm can be kept to a self-choice pace, depending on moment or depth of bass. I don't really know, but somebody said some musical rhythm can mess.
Sorry. Just about your first.
That was first. And that was the one that Russell was talking about that right. He heard before yeah. We met. So.
And it sold.
Did good, whatever it was, I don't know.
About 10.
Again, it did good in whatever it was then, you know, it was.
So that's what you heard first.
That's the record I heard
and
on the radio. That
made
out.
You decide.
Fascinated to meet him. But then, because he made this brilliant record, but then going to his dorm and hearing all of those drum beats, like, you know, the wealth of, you know, of a, you know, product that, you know.
Just
and,
tell
and,
me what, because I'm ignorant. What is these 50 drum beats? What does that exactly mean?
See, there's no music. There's just scratching and a beat, right? And it allows the artist to breathe. He respect, like the artist needed to breathe, you know, just the drums. That was the realest shit you could do. All the other stuff was polished and it was in the way. And he allowed the artist some freedom. And he had other tracks that were inspired in the same way.
But when you were talking about the equipment, you were also
just the drum machine stored on the machine with other beats that could have made records like that, and they did.
And
I programmed these beats in this machine.
Right.
Everybody knows what he's saying.
No, I know. I just want to be sure that I'm getting it. What was your? I mean, describe your dorm. Was it a little room? Or
it was like a.
Was it NYU?
It was
right?
At NYU,
what
five
were you
university
what
place.
What were you studying,
Weinstein.
By the way?
I was a philosophy major at first, and then after 2 years, I switched to film and television because all my friends are in film and television, and it seemed more fun.
You got a degree?
Yeah.
You didn't know that?
I kind of forgot.
So philosophy didn't do it for you?
No, I loved it. I just had more fun in the other classes.
So it was a little cubicle of a room? And
yeah, I would say it was like a 9-foot by 12-foot cinder block room. And I had a full PA system, like a club PA system.
Ridiculous.
It was ridiculous.
Ridiculous. The speakers were like,
it went literally to the ceiling of the room.
And how did your neighbors like it?
The college was so bad.
It was, became...
Popular.
Popular.
Some people liked it.
And that's where submissions were sent to after
yes.
a while.
Yes.
So there was a...
On that record that we just heard,
yeah.
the address for the record company was 5 University Place, the dorm at NYU.
And the record, go ahead.
And so demos would start coming to 5 University Place, and that was Def Jam.
So the guard at NYU would be getting these submissions, and he knew that some business was being done at NYU.
True. And then eventually, a lot of business was done because we'd have, you know, boxes of thousands of records shipped to the dorm, would all be, you'd walk into the dorm, and behind the where the guy sits there, the front deskman, there were hundreds of boxes of records being shipped out, on a daily basis.
That was our man, Rick.
It was crazy.
The door guy, the dude who ran the dorm, was our man. So we was close to him, and he allowed for a lot of a little.
He ended up directing some videos for us as well. He
directed.
He did.
What were you going to say? He allowed for a lot of.
The shit that wasn't supposed to do. He did a lot of stuff with us and allowed us, and we then afforded him the chance to direct videos.
But he made incredible videos. He made Going Back to Cali.
He wrote the script for Tougher Than Leather.
He did.
The script of?
Tougher Than Leather, the movie that we made. He wrote the script, the door guy for the dorm.
He got an education too.
Yeah, we all did.
Yeah. Yeah, made some great videos too. That's right.
I did.
Before the track we just heard, you were already pretty famous. I'd like us to listen to
famous
track 3.
What circle are you? Okay.
Was the night before Christmas and all through the
hold
house.
It now, wait, hold it. That's played it out. Hit it.
You give me all that jive about things you wrote before I was alive. Cause this ain't 1823, ain't even 1970. Now I'm the guy named Curtis Blow, and Christmas is one thing I know. So every year, just about this time, I celebrate it with a rhyme. Gonna shake it, gonna bake it, gonna make it good. Gonna rock, shock, rock it through your neighborhood. Gonna read, gonna sing it till it's understood. My rap about to happen like a knee. You were slapping on, though you've been tapping on a hunk of wood. Bought a red suited dude with a friendly attitude and a sleigh full of goodies for the people on the block. Got a long white beard, maybe looks kind of weird. And if you ever see him, he can give you quite
so
a shot.
So Curtis Blow, tell us something about...
Went to City College with Curtis Blow, and my first experience going to that club, it was Eddie Chiba, and Curtis Blow was cool DJ Kurt, and we really wanted to compete. I fell in love with rap after that first experience. I started promoting parties in Manhattan and Queens and places, and we thought Blow was better than Chiba. Chiba, no, they get it.
No, you
got it, right?
I got it, kind of. But my mother always told me, when you don't understand, just smile.
No. Well, okay. Eddie Chiba was a rapper. He was very popular. He was becoming popular when I first discovered him. Curtis Blow was with me, and that inspired me so much. And Curtis Blow was also a rapper, or became a rapper, right around that time. And he was cool DJ Kurt. We became Curtis Blow because Blow is cocaine, and Chiba... is marijuana, and Blow costs more than Chiba. It's kind of a silly reason, but anyway, the record plays every Christmas, and it was me failing in school, me working hard, but my senior year in school, I just couldn't get past any more classes. I was just in love with promoting these artists, and so that record, by promoting these shows, Robert Ford and J.B. Moore, God bless them, because they had all the faith and. Anything I learned about artist development, I learned from Robert Ford. And JB produced that record. That record was Christmas rapping. And I remember taking them to the Hotel Diplomat and to watch. And Curtis Blow was opening for Flash. Well, I'm sorry, Curtis Blow was one of the MCs for Grandmaster Flash. And they saw, Eddie Chiba perform that night as well. There was a shootout that night. I remember leaving. Anyway, with the box off of the guy, and Curtis Blow opened up and he came out. It was like, and Flash was this really underground rapper who had never played. He was not underground anywhere but Manhattan and Queens, but in the Bronx, he was huge but younger and played to a much more more alternative crowd than Eddie Chiba and others who were more polished, if, whatever that meant. They were more polished than Flash. And Curtis Blow opened up, and he had this classic introduction. And they saw that and changed their mind from doing an Eddie Cheever record to a Curtis Blow record. And then they produced this record, Christmas Rapping. Robert Ford taught me to manage. I became the manager. They were the producer. 1979. What are you looking at me like that?
No, I've learned a lot of... A lot.
And eventually that record...
A lot of stuff. I mean, I've learned how to, you know, ask for the right drug. I'd like us to listen to track number 5 of Run DMC, Sucker MC. You say as people can probably tell, my knowledge of this is deep. You say Sucker MC was the first track I had heard that reflected what goes on in the club. So that was the idea, to create records that made me feel what I felt when I went to a club and heard incredible DJs cutting it up and great MCs rocking the crowd. So I'd like us to take a listen to that.
A friend of mine asked me to say some MC rhyme, so I said this rhyme I'm about to say. The rhyme was there, but then it went this way. Took a test to become an MC, and Orange Cut became amazed at me. So Larry put me inside the gap to lack. The sugar drove off and we never came back. Dave cut the record down to the bone, and now they got me rocking on the microphone. And then we're talking autographs and tears and laughs, and champagne, caviar, and bubble bath. This here, that's the life that I lead. And you sucker MC, it's who I be. So take that and move back, catch a heart attack, because there's nothing in the world that run no level like a cold chill at a party in the B-boy stand. And rock on the mic and make the girls wanna dance. Fly like a dove and come from up above.
Fantastic. It really... So you... There you were really working together on that.
That was me being inspired by him. That was him.
No, that was actually Larry Smith. It was a beat that I had actually written for a previous record for a band, Orange Crush. But then the drum machine came out, and Larry just tapped the beat out. And it's like, oh, shit. And then we must have spent 12 hours on the drum sound. And it was also bottled up, like, you know, having... watched all these talented producers make these beautiful records, and there were many that were around me, but making a record myself, wanting to strip it down and make it honest, or what I thought was honest expression. And like I said, this record, this was the experience when everybody's like, well, what are we gonna do tomorrow? I said, we're gonna mix it. So there's no music yet, there's not gonna be any. And that was the experience, that was like, you know, and this from ignorance that, you know, allowed, because people who have habit or experiences probably would want to put a bass line on that or a guitar or something, but we were done.
You were done, meaning that was enough.
We laid it down. We were happy. DMC was happy.
That was the breakthrough.
That was the breakthrough. It's not a record. It's an idea. For us to have just be able to go home and say we're done and rest in the fact that the record feels good like it is. It doesn't need anything else.
The breakthrough, what do you mean by that?
It's not a record. It's an idea, a breakthrough with a different...
It was a new kind of music. That record signified a change in how
music
could be. Because it was different
it seems
before
simple,
that
but
song.
But back then there were no records. There were only drum beats. And only one drum machine played one program, and then we could go home. That's a lot, you know. But it was the artist that was being highlighted, and it gave him the idea I told you, to let the artist breathe. And that's what it was.
You know what's interesting, too, is if we look back, if you went to a hip-hop club, the beats that the DJs would be playing would mainly be the drum break in a record.
Period.
So we were used to hearing drum beats and vocals, but just not on a record. You'd hear that at a club,
but you'd
never hear it on a record.
It was just a simple thing. It wasn't a genius thing to do. It was just a thing that people have habit and didn't know how to do. And from having these experiences of being there, it just... was a natural thing to do, but it was not natural for, you know,
to anyone who wasn't versed in hip-hop. It would sound alien, but if you'd been in a hip-hop club, you wouldn't think that needed anything else, because you'd know, well, that would be maybe a high point in a show.
But you brought people into understanding that world, even though they hadn't been to hip-hop clubs.
I don't even know if it was understanding. It was just showing it to them, and they liked it.
It was about, it's the same
thing. It's about taste.
Yeah, but I think also, you know, the culture thing happens. You walk the street, you smell things, and then you make a version of it. Sometimes that version of it doesn't have the trappings of everything else, but it could be right there. In other words, it felt like everybody's supposed to go crazy, but maybe it was only my best friends that would all like it. Yeah. Now, the rest of the world wouldn't give a shit. It was a B-side of a record that we put there because we liked it.
And you say this in the book. I find this line most exciting. You say, it was through Def Jam that God first showed me the power of faith. You put your head down and do your work and realize that work is a prayer. When I was producing a record, I never thought, wait till I get a check.
I said that again.
I was thinking, wait till friends hear this.
That's right. Wait till your friends.
All I wanted was to inspire my friends, and that was my first realization that investing yourself totally in something could be fruitful.
That's it.
Fantastic. If you don't mind, I want to read your few lines. There are a few lines at the beginning. I'd love to read it all, but we have other things to do as well. Rick Rubin, you write, Def Jam was about purity of intention and the love of an underground culture. Def Jam was a collection of outsiders. We lived for music first and organized the rest of our lives around one passion, our passion. Def Jam was total immersion in the hip-hop experience manifest in recordings, yet it was more than just music. We flew our colors in the form of Def Jam jackets and found home within our small circle. It was as if we had a special secret that nobody else was aware of. Our inexperience, I love that, our inexperience and innocence allowed us to make music that went beyond the accepted norm. Enthusiasm drove us. It was and continues to be a great love affair with a primal universal life force as glimpsed through the prism of the beat. Great.
You wrote that shit?
Great. I mean, great.
Oh my God, give me chills.
Isn't that great?
That's beautiful. I gotta read that shit.
you hadn't yet read it. It's pretty great. No?
It is really
the
great.
Delivery had a lot to do with that. That was really well done. Very well done.
No, I think you're both.
No, but I think, and you know, I must say, since they're here in the audience, Leo Cohen's lines are fantastic as well. Def Jam came to life in downtown New York during the early 80s. It was unique and powerful time and place when night after night, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Madonna, Curtis Blow were colliding. All the elements that anyone needed to start a fire were present. Fuel, oxygen, and a spark. The fuel was rap music, these amazing beats and rhythms that could not be contained. The oxygen was a downtown scene which was hungry for the newest art, fashion, and music. And the spark, I love this also, the spark was our innocence. The burning desire to run our own hip-hop record label was uncomplicated by any idea of how absurdly difficult it would be if we had known anything in italics. We would have run for the hills. But our success speaks of the lure of random possibility. Fantastic also, wherever you are. If all of you do is figure the odds, these long shots are always absurd. Me, I never let myself be lullabied. If hip-hop and Def Jam in particular has taught me anything, it's that, this is also fantastic. It is if mutant mistakes. I mean, those two words I have never read before. It is as if mutant mistakes often pay off in ways no one else can predict. You would have thought back in the 80s that we'd never see a coffee table book about rap. We'll talk about that. All those years later, I still wake up every morning with the thought that maybe today I'll bump into the next world-changing mutant mistake and have a sense. Yeah, wow, exactly. And have a sense to recognize it. It's just great. Great. Fantastic. I mean, that's what I find so, just, you know, the enthusiasm, the belief in a culture, the belief that you can smell it. It is extraordinary.
Okay.
And where is it around now? And is it around now?
What do you mean?
It's always around. It's always around.
It's always around.
Of course.
Okay. I'm just getting excited.
I'm happy.
Oh, well, that's good. Let's be happy and listen to track number two.
LL Cool J is hard as hell. Battle anybody, I don't care, you tell. I excel, they all fail. Gonna sell double.
Around, you know, doing that first album, and around that time, LL, that's when I said that Rick is a genius earlier, but, you know, this is when he started to, you know, explore his genius, when he started to really expose it in more ways. I mean, Tito Rock's record's great, it's a first effort, you know, and it's really, what it was, it's the genius of, like I said, that there was when I made those records, they were records because no one would make them. Like, just because no one will make them. He made them not only because no one would make them, he made them in a way no one could make them. Mm. He made them so excellent. He was so good at it. So much, you know, he took it to another level. And then by then, the people were starting to borrow ideas or be inspired by what we did, and we weren't alone in making records that reminded you of, that were really good expressions of the culture. People just said, oh, well, can we do that? After that, it's like, can we do that? Because that's really what we want to do anyway. Like, could you imagine if you were on one of these other labels and it was owned by an R&B producer, and they'd say, okay, this is your track, and that's your track, and this is a big record that's out, you can rap over that, and here's something kind of new, but it's really that other shit. And they, all the rappers would take what they got. And we tailor-made things that let the artist breathe. And then people started to do that. And then for Def Jam to come after it had already been instrumental in creating a kind of a freedom, then he had to make the shit where no one else could make it. And Rick made records at that time that was so good for hip-hop, so special for hip-hop, that that's what made Def Jam the best for that moment, and lots of other moments that we've had with Leo's genius and finding so many great records and with all the support, and then Kevin, and what we've been lucky to keep the creativity, but there was a moment he stepped up and made records, produced records that were just better than everybody else's. And even when I got to collaborate with him on the Raising Hell album, it was a phenomenal experience because he would do things that was a much...
When you say do, what do you mean?
Just, you know, we're going to make toys in the attic. Well, this was different because he made Walk This Way because we're going to make toys in the attic.
And he said, well, you ever heard of Aerosmith? He said, no, what is that? You know, we were going to scratch up toys in the attic and rap over the beat. He said, no, I know a group, Aerosmith. That's their record. We're going to fuck with them. I said, really?
You didn't know?
We had no idea. We never, Toys in the Attic was a record we scratched in the park and never cared about the artist. As soon as they start to open their mouth, we cut the record. Fuck them. We would play the instrumental in the beginning and go, and most they'd say the beginning of a guitar rip would play for a minute, but that was it. And so that was just part of the way we made the Peter Pipers and other records in the album. And Rick said, no, we're gonna make the record.
And what did that
but that was that was also his history, his cultural insight that was different, that was part of emerging cultures.
What do you mean when you say that? What do you mean when but you say cultural insight?
Well, his insight, Rick Rubin grew up with, he liked loud, abrasive music, and we liked loud, abrasive music. But we didn't have the library and the history of growing up with the punk rock experience. He was in a punk rock band.
Yeah, I agree.
You know,
that.
He really lived alternative music that needed to merge. We were not accepted downtown in the black clubs, Leviticus, and I could name them all, that we couldn't go to until finally I was able to go and try to make them play my record, and they still wouldn't fuck with my records. We had to go all the way downtown. We had to go to the Mud Club and the Ritz and all the punk. And so we had this experience developing. We found Rick in Danceteria, really. I mean, we met him different places, but in Danceteria, where the only place that played a rap record beside the South Bronx was at Danceteria or the Ritz or the punk rock clubs. So Rick was there. And so Rick had all that experience to bring. And that's why making that album with Rick was the greatest experience, cultural, creative experience I was ever privileged to be part of. Because just to watch the way Jay, myself, and everybody interacted with what Rick brought, which is now, I mean, it's all documented. This fucker makes everybody from Krishna Das to Slayer. You know, he makes deep spiritual records by alternative spiritual teachers to devil worship records. From Johnny Cash to the Ghetto Boys, he's and you go all in between, all everything.
So what you would say is just voracious appetite, just endless appetite.
Melody was the thing. He was a much greater than a beat man. He was a melody man. He was he's maybe the greatest producer ever. Yeah. If he wasn't here, I would say the greatest producer ever. He wasn't sitting here.
It's interesting to me also on the tales of this week, because 2 days ago I had Harry Belafonte on this stage, and he was talking about great difficulties being in the Thunderbird in Las Vegas and not being able really to get through the door, because he had an incredible difficulty being accepted as a black man, and here you are working with a white man, and I'm wondering, were there issues there? Was it difficult?
I've always loved and always thought the culture was for everyone, but I always also thought that diversity was such an important thing. I stress it every day. The integration of all of these ideas that make the great new American cultural things has been, for me, my life's work. And I always believe, so working with Rick and whatever was different that he brought to the table was not only welcome, it was inspiring.
It was an enhancement.
It was an enhancement in every way. And so that's my answer to that, I guess.
For you, being
for me,
surrounded by a black world,
it was amazing that I was accepted into this world that was different. Out of this shared love of this art.
It was the passion of the music, as you say, that...
Absolutely.
Because, the other day, Belafonte was talking about, Martin Luther King, the March on Washington, what he wanted to do, and what he was able to do with his celebrity, is bring together all these incredible artists. I mean, incredible, from Marlon Brando to Tony Bennett. But also, Martin Luther King said, bring the enemies, bring Charlton Heston. He needs to come down too. Bring the other side. Bring the great diversity of this country down, because that's what's important, and that's what the 200,000 people who marched down, and maybe there may have been more, it was important to bring down a panoply.
It's, you know, it's still important. I want to say, you know, as much as I love the integration that Def Jam represented of culture and how much it affected people and brought people together, still today, a lot of what they call integration equals and diversity and integration really, it doesn't really mean integration. It's still segregated. There's still a segregation that exists, you know, and I gotta mention it because it's, you know, it needs a continuously be explored. How do we find, you know, this merger to make, you know, 1 and 1 3? Almost every instance it does. You have to be able to be comfortable doing it. And I think that there was, you know, there's a moment always where it doesn't seem normal. You know, when he was a DJ double R when I met him.
He was a what?
DJ for the Beastie Boys, yeah, as well. You know, as their producer and partner. So seeing that was like so exciting, but you know, everyone didn't necessarily see that. So I want more people to be like that. And even 20 some odd years later, I still find that, you know, there's still
work to
people
be done.
Like to put compartmentalize whatever they find. And Rick never did that in terms of the way he produced.
You probably couldn't.
Didn't know how.
No, I just like music. I never saw anything other than good music.
But what, your seven words. A music fan. I mean, that's basically what it is.
I think if you look back at the music business from the 50s and 60s, it was often white-owned companies selling black artists' music. And I guess it was unique at Def Jam, and by no plan, it just worked out that it was owned by black and white people, and the artists were black and white. And just felt it was a natural thing that just happened.
It was multiracial, but singularly cultural.
Yeah.
Let's look at video track A, please.
They're looking at video.
$50,000, maybe more. I'd like to take a look at your books. Did you bring them with you?
Sure.
If there's anything in there you don't understand, I can explain it to you. I wrote it myself.
Won't be necessary.
Thanks. You got it.
What kind of record company do you have?
What kind?
You know, what type of music?
Rap music.
What?
Rap music.
What is rap music?
Let's just show them. Right. An insurmountable beat, subject of discussion.
We can sell records with the aid of percussion.
There's no category
for this story.
We can make lots of money in any territory. If you give us this loan.
Gentlemen, please, I get the idea.
Good.
I'm very sorry, but there's absolutely no way I can offer you a loan at this time.
What are you saying?
No.
Oh, they cut it out. They cut it out. I feel so bad for Rick. I mean, because that was, I remember the moment that we saw that footage, we both cringed. I said, damn, you, I mean, it was such the worst acting. And that scene was such... And the movie's not that bad, I promise you, if you haven't seen Crush Groove. But it was an embarrassing moment for Rick, and he just sat here, and it came on. I looked at him, and I was like...
Well, he
and that was Bland with not me, so I didn't get the same kind of embarrassment.
Why did you not play you?
Such a bad... Huh? Why well, I was high.
He was smart. He was smart.
Bland was a better me, you know. I would go places for years, and they'd be looking for Blair. I mean, girls would be like, is Blair, is Russell here? I'm like, I'm Russell. No, you ain't.
That was your only attempt at rapping?
Yes. Thankfully.
Why'd you pick that scene? I'm just curious.
I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting also in terms of acceptance. I think it's interesting that, it wasn't a done deal. You had to do it yourself. You wouldn't get a loan that easily. I thought the subject matter was interesting.
That was a fictional movie. Not,
but the fiction turned into reality. You created your own
yes.
gig. Okay, let's move right along and look. I can see the pain, but we'll get over it. I promise you. Let's move. To Walk the Way, track 6.
You're perfect. Hmm? You're such an
Smith's Walk This Way. I said Walk The Way. Forgive me. Talk to us about that.
The purpose of that song, that was, very few of the songs had purposes. That one had an actual purpose, which was, up until that point, rap music was so alien to anyone who wasn't in the hip-hop culture that I remember I was in California and talking to these people at this record company who were fans of what we did because of the success we were having, and they said, you know, why do people like this? These are people who were being nice to me, were saying, why do people like this? It's not music. And I realized, you know, there's a pretty big gulf between how we felt about this and how people perceived it other than our small little world. And I wanted to find a song that would help bridge that gap so that people understood it really wasn't that different. It really wasn't. And the Aerosmith song, Walk This Way, that was just the Run DMC version of it, is very close to a rap song already in its Aerosmith version. And I thought if Run DMC did a cover of that song as Run DMC, just like Run DMC would do it, people would make the connection like, oh, well, I've heard Aerosmith do this, and now Run DMC are doing it.
You're making a bridge.
Connecting the dots.
You're making a bridge.
It's not so far from popular music of the day.
And so that's what created the bridge, effectively?
I think so. I think that was it was the purpose of it, and it was to really, like, educate people that this thing that you don't understand, here's maybe one where if you hear it, it's in a format that you can accept. And then once you accept it, maybe that'll be a gateway into the whole hip-hop world. And it sort of functioned in that way.
Russell, did you want to add something?
No, I think that, you know, it also, for me, you know, I was a co-producer on the album, but not really on that record. In other words, I sat there, I helped them, you know, get them to say the vocals properly. It was kind of difficult for them too, because they really were into the Toys in the Attic, whoever that was. It was just the name of the album, and in case you don't know, and they were into, like, you know how you go rent, rent, rent. That was all you would hear the guitar. So Rick, you know, pulling them along, you know, and when they got into it, they loved it, but he had to give them the space to see it, you know, because they hadn't had any experience with it. So it was really, you know, again, what I said earlier about Rick and his experiences, you know, and what I say about one and one equaling three. You know, or really two and a half of one. We had a mission in hip-hop, and he had a different perspective of it, different perspective of it that kind of helped us to broaden the entire landscape, you know. So that was that experience. And Walk This Way was, we didn't make it a single. It made itself a single instantly when it came out. And it was what Rick had envisioned, you know. So, you know, that's the experience.
I mentioned earlier on that I've recently discovered the Beastie Boys. I'd like us to take a look, please, at track C.
Now, boys, don't get into any trouble while Mommy and Daddy are gone. And don't make a mess.
Do you like parties?
Yeah.
We can invite all our friends and have soda and pie.
Yeah!
I hope no bad people show up.
Ah!
say I loved watching that. What does it inspire in you so many years afterwards?
It's just really funny.
It's really funny, yeah.
Ridiculous.
Is it good music?
Yeah, great.
It was really funny. The Beastie Boys, they made that record, and it became a hit, and it was like kind of, they backed their way into a hit. Not quite the same as Walk This Way in its own way, because they never thought that'd be a single. It made itself a single. They didn't perform it. I don't know if they perform it now, because it was just a fun record. And, it's like Lior said, mistakes. I think that was Lior's quote, mistakes, right? It was kind of not a mistake. I mean, it's like the kind of damage that to building a career you have to really work at to protect, that becomes the image of the band. Because they were so talented, they did so many great alternative fun records. That was a fun record, but it was not the branded record that we wanted for their image. We had so many great records that represented who they were, but they were just too far for the mainstream to accept. And we were never chasing the mainstream. We never expected or wanted the mainstream, not really. So after that, on the road, we never performed that record. We went on the road, and they went on the road, never performed it, because it was not really what their fans wanted from them. It was a lot of exposure, but it was not what their fans wanted from them. And those who got that record maybe were converted when they understood the real integrity of the group. So that's the story there, in my opinion. I think Rick, you'd probably agree, right?
Yeah.
It's just really funny.
It is really funny.
Yeah. It was a commercial for the
right.
album. And it was funny. And it made us laugh. And that was the goal with
funny.
All the music we made with the Beastie Boys, was just making records that we would like and we would laugh at, with all these crazy inside jokes. And if 50 people liked it, we would have been ecstatic. There was no, we would never think anybody was going to like this album.
And we certainly didn't think they'd like that record. Anyway, here's the thing. As a brand, as a manager, I said that early on, Robert Ford reminded, we would always, when we had a record that we thought would broaden the boundaries of what an artist's potential was, we would always put a B-side on it, because a B-side would speak directly to the core community that we really liked, our best friends. Our best friends wouldn't have chosen that record over the other, how many records on that album?
12.
I think 11, the other 11 records, our best friends who loved rap the most, who frequented rap clubs, would have chosen those records first. So it didn't hurt, but it expanded everything for them. But because the record had so much integrity, there were so many great records that kind of spoke to the heart of hip-hop.
The heart of hip-hop was more espoused in your view by Public Enemy and Chuck D.
Oh, in my view. But not necessarily than more than the other Beastie Boy records, but they were their own honest, authentic thing. Rick fell in love with them and begged Chuck D to sign. He'll tell you the story.
Tell us a story.
Chuck, this is at the time of LL Cool J's first album coming out and doing very well. And Chuck was probably, I'm going to guess, 21 years old. LL was 16.
Young. Yeah.
And Chuck felt like he was too old to be a rapper because LL's 16, and he had already made two singles with a group called Spectrum City that didn't do well, and he thought, my music career is over. And I called him every day for probably 6 months to convince him to record for us, because there was such a small pool of talent. There was nobody great, and Chuck was great, and we knew Chuck was great, and we loved Chuck. And
he gave in.
Eventually, he called, said he wanted to meet, and he came, and all I knew about was Chuck D. I didn't know anything. There was no such thing as Public Enemy at that time. There was no such thing, Flavor. None of that had existed yet. He came in with 10 people, and he said, I'm ready to do this. The group is called Public Enemy. It's me and Flavor, and this is how it's in, and Griff and the S1Ws, and we have this whole vision. And like, great. And that was what made it okay for him to do it, was that he didn't feel like he was competing on a one-on-one basis with 16-year-old LL Cool J. He had the S1Ws, and it was a different it was like a band. He saw it as a punk rock band, kind of inspired by The Clash. So that was his...
And he came up with that name?
Completely. They came up with everything. They brought it all to
and
us.
And your reaction was?
Great. I love Chuck. I was willing to go on any trip he wanted to go on.
Let's look at track D of the video.
Playback!
Music hit your heart, cause I know you got a soul.
Hey,
listen if you're missing, y'all. Swinging while I'm singing.
Hey,
giving what you're getting. Knowing what I'm knowing. While the black man's sweating. In the rhythm I'm rolling. Gotta give us what we want. Gotta give us what we need.
Hey,
our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power.
Power,
that beat. Algorithms designed to bounce with health essential
rhymes.
Designed to fill your mind now that you realize the prize arrives.
We got
to pump the stuff to make it hot. From the heart, it's a start, a work of art to revolutionize. Make a change, something strange.
People, people,
we all the same. No, we're not the same, cause we don't know the game. What we need is awareness. We can't get careless.
You say, what is this?
All of it. Let's get down to business. Mental self-defense of fitness.
The
rest is show.
You got to go what you know.
To make everybody see. In order to fight the powers that be.
I got
it.
When I see that, and you ask me to reflect on that, I have so many thoughts. It's difficult to I can say that when the first album, and it was really Rick who, like he said, called every single day. The first album, there were really good things about it, and there was some criticism because they were very, but they said a lot of very important social and political things, but it was also a very tough album, very street, pre-gangster rap, but a lot of this shit was really gangster, you know, and so it was, and so I remember, I always thought I said this, but then somebody told me that it was Bill Stephanie who said, the bullets are their word, the Uzi weighs a ton was the song in question. Because it was my favorite on that first album, and it was also a record that, you know, caused some controversy, although it wasn't a big hit or pop record on the radio. It was, my Uzi weighs a ton. And his mouth was his Uzi, and the bullets were his words. And from then, hearing it, or whether I came up with it, wherever it came from, it stuck in my head, and I realized, I listened to all the album again and again, and it was such a revolutionary album. And then the next album, and in between, I think you helped Rebel Without a Pause, came out, and that was the record that really, they were coming into their own, and then this, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back.
Which you were crying on the, you heard it for the first time on the airplane. And you
that kind of shit.
It just moved me. I couldn't believe that anybody made anything so beautiful. I could tear up now thinking about hearing it for the first time.
Well, I asked you while you were watching it, when you saw this last, you said 20 years ago.
Probably.
But I read video? You were on a plane, and it just made you cry to hear this.
So phenomenal.
It was so beautiful. It was so revolutionary and so passionate and so strong.
But it's cultural impact, too.
It's
all music. It's all a heart. It's all what you felt in the experience. And what Rick is describing is how breathtaking the music is and how it feels. But what it did, you know, changed what kids were thinking, what adults were thinking, it changed the climate, it created the Million Man March.
It changed what rap could be.
It changed
everything.
What rap could be. Because up until that point, there was no content like Chuck was talking about in rap records.
No.
There was bragging, there was dissing, but there was very little social commentary outside of the neighborhood. And he was talking about bigger things and politics.
There were social implications, and there were always political implications in all the poetry, even in the stuff that you think is small and separate, and it means something politically and socially. But what Chuck D was saying and what he did to affect the community is proof that, you know, you have to be each individual has to at least be concerned with what he represents, because the effect of Chuck D took all the gold chains off people's neck and put red, black, and green around their neck. He got Rick Rubin to go see Minister Farrakhan speak. He went to the masses. There was a revolution that he was in the center of and helped to change for a significant amount of time. It was a significant change in the black community that was a very positive change. And it was about consciousness and all the things that, you know, that. And it was, so it was just,
then there was
but it wasn't that, it was the music.
There was a positive change, and then there was your, in some way, perhaps distancing in some way from Public Enemy. You have this line, which I think is strongly provocative. If Public Enemy wants to do songs about killing Whitey, and I'm Whitey, that's fine. And I'll support them in that attempt, as long as what they do is good musically, which is all I really care about. And then you say, I'm going to read this quotation because I find it so fantastic. It's only commentary. I don't think music can change the world. It's okay to say anything in art. Public, and I believe this so deeply working in this library, everything has to be part of this place.
Absolutely.
Everything. From Plato to NATO, from Beowulf to Virginia Woolf, everything has to be part of this place. We have to collect everything with discrimination, of course, but we have to bring it under one roof.
Rick said, as an artist, what he said was absolutely right, and I agree 100%. I'm never offended by what's on a record or even by people's opinions. But what I'm saying to you is that taking a seed and making it really affect all of culture affects humankind's consciousness in many ways. So it doesn't, you don't have to be offended by it unless you're holding, you know, some kind of a fear inside you. But this reality being expressed is important. Well, it's a reality that's in the hearts of people, and taking that seed and spreading it is an artist. It doesn't have to be his, it's his heart he's spreading. But but each person can be mindful and conscious of what's in their heart. And what Chuck D said was inspiring and uplifting. He never said about, and Rick had to defend himself in some of those lines saying it, because he never said about hurting anyone. He never said anything that was not, you know, not intended to uplift and inspire. So you have nothing to be afraid of, or even to have a feel of threatened by. He just said a lot of truth that's hard to digest. And there was nothing wrong with that. So there's nothing wrong with any of it. As Rick said, Rick went on to produce the Ghetto Boys.
Well, you know,
y'all know them.
Rick speaks in the same commentary about the fact, I mean, these are not, you know, politicians in power.
No, these are
artists.
These are people expressing their
and
true
we should
feelings.
Be, and as
everyone's
say,
entitled
we,
to their feelings.
And we should be exposed to everything.
Absolutely. Otherwise, you're not living in reality. That's right. If you just assume everybody thinks the same thing you do or only agree with that.
Right.
You went your separate ways.
I went and produced Orange Juice Jones. He went and made Slayer. Like Slayer. You can talk about that if you want.
Yeah, it just felt like our friendship was so strong, and our business grew very big, very fast.
Yeah.
And I don't think either of us really knew how to handle what it was. And really, for me, out of wanting to protect our friendship, which has never dimmed in all this time, I said, you know, maybe one of us should not be here. And I said, do you want to leave? And he said, no, I don't want to leave. And I said, okay, then I'll leave. And then we just continued doing what we liked. And it really had more to do with, now looking back,
yeah,
I could see.
Retrospectively.
Then I didn't know. Again, we're kids. But looking back, it had more to do with the fact that there was no infrastructure, really, and that people, there was such a volume of stuff to deal with. And people would bring the same problems to me and to Russell. We would handle them differently. We would get each other frustrated, but there was no way of dealing with anything, and there were so many fires going on all the time that had to be put out. Whoever was closest put them out, and sometimes I'd be upset with the way Russell put out a fire, sometimes he'd be upset with the way I put out a fire, and there was no system in place. So I felt like because of our love for each other, it'd be better just to do
chill
the same thing separately.
Else, yeah.
But I can say also about us being young, and I can look back and maybe say this, I don't know if you agree with
younger.
We had our responsibility to the label. And Rick made the most beautiful LL Cool J record. But Rick, you know, also all of his life, he's, you know, he never gotten a chance to, from a music standpoint, to live in a playground. To live in a playground, producing not Slayer, but the other rock bands and other things, and they all had this new experience included in the way he made their records. Rick was a creative spirit that needed to make what he wanted, and me, growing up, also, you know, I didn't like the shit they did, but there was some stuff that was pre what was hot that I wanted to emulate. I made my Juice Jones and my Allison Williams, and, you know, we had some hits, and he made his Slayers and his Four Horsemen, you know.
Yeah,
and then meanwhile, we had the L.A. Posse making LL Cool J.
Right.
And we had, you know, we had artists, and so we were not, Def Jam was a rap label. We made an R&B label separate, and we made kind of a rock label separate. But we didn't have any adults supervising our effort, and good, because we were creative, and we had fun. I got to make a Blue Magic album. I still hear it sometimes. It didn't sell much, but I still hear that motherfucker. I made a Blue Magic album. I grew up on Blue Magic. I had fun doing that. So we had great experiences. You know, and me being less creative and more of another side of my brain operating, I went back to work kind of. And then Leor, who had been the manager of so many of the acts and helped me with management, he helped, stepped in and bring some kind of organization to the company and also a creative input and a business input. So we just carried on. We survived. But we had to go out because we had nothing like this. We had to go out and find a lot of great, talented people, and we were lucky.
And you both in closing.
But he went on and became, you know what the fuck he did.
Yeah.
He went. So we were lucky that we both got to survive.
Well, in closing, I want to talk a little bit about what you did separately, and then bring back what you did together. Separately, you discovered Slick Rick.
Rick was there. Leo was there. We all liked it. We all have different stories of it. We went one place. Leo was very intent on signing it. Rick was very intent on. We all liked him, and we got Slick Rick. We were still together. We put out Children's Story as a team. Rick produced some of the songs on Children's Story, and Jam Master Jay put and the group that we found with Public Enemy, the Bomb Squad. Remember, we worked for so long on that album, and we had all these producers. Then one day, Hank Shockley walked in, the brilliant man that he was. And that was an amazing creative team. They walked in after we had frustrated ourselves, right, trying to get Slick Rick to record these records, and he just gelled, and they made a whole album in a few weeks after we had done so much for so many years trying to get a record, not a year and a half or something. He just went in and made the record, and that was one of the best records Def Jam's ever had, and it was made by the Bomb Squad for the most part.
So Children's Story, you still made together? You had not left the company at that point?
I was instrumental in bringing him to the label. Russell and Leor signed him. And they oversaw the making of the record with Hank.
Let's look quickly.
You made records on the album,
track E,
Rick.
If we could.
You got records on the album, you crazy. You made Treat Her Like a Prostitute.
That's true.
Once upon a time, not long ago, when people wore pajamas and lived life slow, where laws were stern and justice stood, and people were behaving like they ought to good, there lived a little boy who was misled by another little boy, and this is what he said. Me and you tonight, we're gonna make some cash, robbing old folks and making the dash. They did the job, money came with ease, but one couldn't stop, it's like he had a disease. He robbed another, and a sister and a brother. Tried to rob a man who was a DT undercover. The cop grabbed his arm, he started acting erratic. He said,
keep still, boy, no need for static.
Punched him in his belly and he gave him a slap. But little did he know, the little boy was strapped. The kid pulled out a gun, he said, why'd you hit me? The barrel was set straight for the cop's kidney. The cop got scared, the kidney starts to figure, I'll do years if I pull this trigger. So he cold dashed and ran around the block. Cop radios into another lady cop. He ran by a tree, there he saw the sister. Shot for the head, he shot back when he missed her. Looked round good and from expectations he decided he'd hit.
I love it. It's wonderful. You went on to do things now, I think, quite separately. The Def Comedy and Def Jam Comedy and the Def Poetry Jam. And I'd like us to look at a track, if we could, track H.
You know how people come out to poetry slams and they light incense and everything. I had to make my own ambiance, you know, for me to feel comfortable. It really don't have nothing to do with the poem whatsoever. I just thought it looked good on TV, so. People always talk about, you know, Kanye, is he, Is he really like that? Is he really that arrogant? I just don't like his attitude. I don't like, you know, they say your attitude determines your latitude. Well, I'm high as a motherfucker, fly as a motherfucker. And still the motherfucker you love to hate, but can't. Because you love what I make. Now ain't that about a bitch. And now I'ma talk shit until I'm out of hits. They don't want to turn the speakers up. They claim I ain't deep enough. All that talking I feed off of. Keep it up. I'm relaxing. My feet is up. I'm leaving you haters like when Shaq left the Lakers just to heat it up. I state the stats to stunt. I don't need the front. Make black history a day. I don't need a month.
Fantastic. Tell us about that adventure. Because it's continuing.
That particular adventure?
That one, and it's continuing.
Well, you know, he was signed through Kevin Lyles and Leo were part of it with Rockefeller, and Damon Dash promoted him to the show. I was still the chairman, but not so involved. But the experience of having him on the show, you know, he was loved. Damon Dash never gets the credit that he deserved. He saw so clearly in this kid a genius that was beyond what anyone else saw. And that was just one, you know, there were great poets coming on that show, and here's an artist who just signed to Def Jam, obligated to do it because I was still working there, but I didn't know. And he was fantastic. He was, you know, the whole experience of Def Poetry was great, but he...
It's incredible. I want to create something like that here on this stage.
A poetry experience?
Yeah, that kind of poetry experience.
Oh, that's easy.
Can we do that?
Yeah, we could do it.
Can you arrange that?
I think we could.
Okay, we'll talk later. I'd like to do that. I think it's just fantastic. I mean, really, and it's a way of getting, you know, since libraries now, one begins to wonder what they are for. What are they for? You know, we ask the same question of how does the music industry work? You know, how do people access knowledge? Why come here? I mean, you can get everything on your computer. You can download everything. You can. We're in a predicament which is very difficult. And yet, I think, I mean, tonight shows it. People want to be together. As I often say, you can't tickle yourself. You know?
That's good.
I mean, you can, but you can't. You know what I mean? There's no real question there. But we're on our way, slowly but surely, winding down. Your experience now over the last few years has been to try to work in an industry that is suffering and that is changing. Bring us up to date.
I just focus on music, try to make the best, help artists make the best music that they can possibly make, and then that does as much of the work as we can do. I think the industry is working on different ways of people getting music that can be monetized, and it's starting to happen more and more, and there are better and better systems, and Wi-Fi is getting better and everywhere, and eventually you'll be able to hear anything you want, anytime you want, anywhere you go, on demand, and it'll be a good experience. And it's moving in that direction.
And people are curating their own track list.
Absolutely.
And you view this purely positively?
Absolutely. Anytime more people get to listen to music, it'll, in the long run, be a good thing. The old system is crumbling. A new system will rise up.
What will the new system be if you had to prophesy?
We don't know. I don't think anybody really knows. I think we have to try a lot of things, and then, like we did Def Jam, we tried stuff. Stuff happened.
You think there's hope for mutant mistakes. There's hope. There's something.
To quote Lior.
Yeah. It's such a wonderful line.
Yes. I gotta say this about Rick. Rick's happy to make a record and everybody hear it.
That is a justification.
That's it. I mean, I'm sorry to talk for you, but, you know, he's trying to answer a question. That's never his concern, in my opinion. I don't have to sit here, look at him to say it. He's concerned. He likes the stuff. Yeah, he likes to make it.
The music.
So the other stuff is crumbling. It's never, not even a thing he's considering.
It doesn't get in the way of making great art. Our job is to make great art.
That's right.
And so the corporations, the industry, all of that doesn't... The fact that one can... You know, there's always this tendency to try to institutionalize... doesn't get in the way of producing great stuff.
Absolutely not. The focus has always been purely on the art, and everything else, luckily so far, has worked itself out.
As we close, I must say that among the things I saw of yours at the Def Jam Poetry, I saw of yours, which we will be hosting at the library soon. I thought I would remind you of this because. I really want this to happen. This library has to breathe new life. We have to not only oxygenate it, but elevate it, levitate it. You know, I always wonder, how much does this library weigh? Nobody has been able to tell me. There are a lot of smart people around, but nobody has a clue. And we have to make it live. And one way of making it live is bringing people in here. They hear this, and maybe they'll get this book, read about it, and learn something. And it's quite extraordinary that it's become a book. It's become this, you know, this experience which was run out of a dorm now becomes this massive Rizzoli, beautifully produced book. One of the in researching and learning about your careers, I was deeply, deeply moved, I must say, by the way you reimagined and reinvigorated the late Johnny Cash, and the work you did, the work you did with him, I find extraordinary, and it really goes back in a way to not that you've ever erred from your origins, but it sort of reinforces the fact that your albums at the beginning were not called produced but reduced. And I'd like us to listen, if we could, to track G.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend. Everyone I know goes away in the end. And you.
It is extraordinary. I must say, how did you make this happen?
I got to meet Johnny Cash and suggested that we start making some music together. And he had already been discarded by his label. At one time in the 70s, he was the number one artist on Columbia Records. And then maybe 7 years later, they dropped him. And he had signed to another label and wasn't having success, and he had he'd really lost faith in himself. And I met with him and talked about the idea of making the best music he had ever made, and not, which was a radical idea for, you know, someone who'd probably made maybe 70 albums by that time, 80 albums, but to not think about...
You presented it that way.
Well, at first it was more let's get together and talk about music, but eventually it became, the goal became, let's make your best album. Let's not stop until we think this is the best you've ever done. And he was, again, taken aback by that idea at first, and then as we started working about it, working on it, he sort of got into the idea of, wow, this could actually be good. And he, through the success of our first album, found faith in himself again, and it allowed us to make, you know, six albums. And
but the choice of that song,
yeah,
how did you come upon that?
That was a song written by Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, and I'm a big Nine Inch Nails fan, and I listened to the words, and the words were written by a guy who's probably 23 years old, written in his bedroom. And when Johnny Cash, 70 at that time, I think, is singing those words, they have an entirely different meaning than when Trent wrote them. And I just heard when looking for songs for Johnny, it was always about the words. He was a great storyteller, and he would tell you a story, and you believed the words he said. And it sounds like he's telling his life story when it's, again, the words of a 23-year-old kid. But he breathed so much life into those lyrics to where, really, I feel like a lot of people got to hear the song for the first time when he sang it. And it felt like it was meant to be written for him to sing it.
It's the pace, the pacing of it, the way it, the clear elocution, the way it's also, I mean, incredibly filmed.
Incredible.
I mean, it's tremendous. And the whole Johnny Cash project now that I've discovered online, which is...
incredible.
Isn't it?
Incredible.
It's like adding an archive to a life. I must say this is and in some way, the word reduction is right here. It's back to the essentials. There's no frou-frou on it. There's no... Is frou-frou a good word?
It was the perfect bookend, because his career started at Sun Records, and he made these incredible records to start with, and then he got very successful, and then there was sort of a middle period where they weren't as good, and then he kind of lost faith in himself, and then to end on such a high note as these albums, it just, and he was the greatest man. He really, if anyone deserved to have the recognition that he got, it was him.
And so you gave him that.
I helped.
You helped him. And if I may, I hope this is not in bad taste, I'd like to recognize Roseanne Cash and her son.
When I said that Rick breathed, gave people a room to breathe, and he produced around them, and he sucked what was best from them, I mean, just listening to him talk about it, it brings you almost to, it's such a special talent.
And he gives
like
back life.
Like you said,
about
listening. And,
yeah.
You know, and, you know, just looking at artists, he'd always look at them and see their essence. Like he said, whatever Chuck wanted to do, because he saw in him something. And when he produced them, he would suck that out of them. He would get them to be their best. And this example, obviously, is, you know, listening to him talk about it, it reminds me of his experiences with his very first artist productions and all the way until we separated. Every time he went in the studio, he went dedicated to making that person the best he could be. And that's a listener, not a controlling, you know, but a person who was giver. And that's what I saw.
In closing, and I promise, Bill Stefney said, in my opinion, it was Rick who built Def Jam without question. But if Rick built Def Jam, it's still subordinate to Russell's building hip-hop. Russell built the culture. There would be no hip, Def Jam, or the success of Rick and Def Jam without the magic of Russell Simmons, who essentially carried the culture on his shoulders and moved it all along. Would you agree with that?
Beautiful. That's a sweet compliment. I just, you know, I went along for a ride with a lot of talented people. I was surrounded by the most talented people, and each one more talented in their field than I was. I was able to aid all of them, do what they do. And this, you know, from Kevin Lyles there, to Julie Greenwald. What, you know, Leor, you know, sending, well, I remember being on the Stairmaster, he sends me a kid from my own neighborhood, Irv Gotti. Brilliant. Did so many, and Irv was bouncing and shit, like, this is what was gonna, they dance like this now, Russ. You know, he's telling me how they dance now, like, I'm that old. I wasn't that old then. But you know, just to keep it alive and to keep finding new talent, and just, I was just, Michael Kaiser, I don't know where he is, but just, Leo kept a team together, people that we started with. Look at Mike Kaiser, president. Kevin Lau, president. Julie Greenwald, president. These are all interns. These fuckers are presidents, all of them. Leo made them all. Chris Lighty. So I was surrounded by a lot of very, very talented people, and I just was lucky enough to get on the ride. It's true.
We're going to close the evening with track B of the video. That's the evening.
Bound man and put his face in the sand. Not the last mafioso, I'm a MC cop. Make it say go LL and do the WAP. If you think you cannot rob me, yeah boy I bet. Cause I ain't met a motherfucker who can do that yet. Trendsetter, I'm better, my rhymes are good. I got a gold nameplate that says I wish you would. And when I begin then, I gotta join in. And before my rhyme is over, you know I'ma win. Cool J has arrived, so you better make way. Ask anybody in the crowd, they say the kid don't play. That's my hobby and job. I don't wear disguise because I don't hold the mob. Got a pinpoint rap that makes you feel trapped. So many girls on my dock, I think my phone is tapped. I'm bad. Cool J. Cool J.
They kidnap Tasha, man. Meet me at the pier right away.
Cool J. Soldier at war, making sure you don't try to battle me no more. Got concrete rhymes, been rapping for 10 years, and even when I'm rapping, I'm being sincere. MC can't win, I make them rust like tin. They call me Jaws, my hat is like a shark's fin. Because I'm bad as can be, got my voice on wax. Some brothers think he's making records, now he must have relaxed. I couldn't, shouldn't, and it'll stay that way. The best rapper you've heard is LL Cool J. Kamikaze, take a look at what I've done. Used to rock in my basement, now I'm number one. And you're acting on time, never standing online. You wanna try me? First you better learn how to rhyme. I'm the pinnacle, that means I reign supreme. And I'm notorious, I'll crush you like a jelly bean. I'm bad.
This thing was
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons,